Hope you enjoyed that. That was two wonderful singers, Mercedes Sosa and Joan Baez, singing Gracias de la Vida, so gratitude, thank you for life. But you didn't need to actually understand all the words to get all the sort of joy and that enjoyment of life communicated through their singing, through their relationship as they were singing together, their connection with other people that they were singing to, the other musicians. So why did I start with that? Well, partly because I really like I like that performance, and I think they're also quite interesting that they're, two artists very dedicated to their craft who came to the, in a way, pinnacle of their own way of their own styles, but who also really quite p political and did a lot for the world. So they had that whole thing of like combining being true to themselves, being true to their art, but also having a a strong impact on the world. And if you want to explore a little bit about them, you might want to. I don't think I've got time to talk about that now. What is interesting, Joan Baez was very supportive of like Martin Luther King, for instance. And a good friend of his apparently, and did a lot of the early sort of rallies and helped with fundraising and things. Anyways, I think it's interesting because I was sort of reflecting on some of the things that Paramananda said yesterday and the sort of material we've been exploring. And suppose it's sort of energized part of me that's sort of been a little bit dormant, which is Bodhi Leela the musician. So you may or may not know that I am a classical musician, and I spent about 16 years being a professional classical musician, freelancing as a viola player, and although I don't really play my viola now, sometimes I mess about on the piano. I guess it is, I am intrinsically, part of me is a musician, and how I respond to the world, even though I may sometimes have completely forgotten about the fact that I'm a musician, is very much influenced by that. And I definitely see so many parallels between my meditation practice and, practicing as a musician. Which I might say a little bit about today. And I think it was also very much influenced because Paramananda did actually bring in sort of like musical terminology in talking about meditation and about us, coming into harmony with ourselves and harmony with the world and reality. So I find that quite interesting, this the word harmony used as a metaphor, and it is used quite a lot within, certainly within Tri Ratna, and even with the order, we have speech precepts about harmonious speech, and I think some people seem to interpret that as there should never be any sort of clash, any disagreement, but actually, what makes harmony interesting is all those discords that then get resolved. Music where you never have any tension, any discord, is very bland. It's that kind of Muzak stuff that you hear piped in supermarkets and lifts that drive me mad. And it is interesting because actually earlier on, I'm talking about I suppose Western European music, harmony wasn't the main way that music was created, the main structure for it. There was this polyphony where rather than trying to create chords and sequences of chords that create the harmony, you just had lots of voices and lots of different voices. Sometimes you might have as many as 40 or 50 interweaving with each other. And we have this idea, I think, of progress, that you move, you know, that as we move on, we get more complex, we get better at things maybe. But actually, it's just you get different times, different styles, different ways of doing things. You know, the music, early music, sometimes very, very simple, very, very profound. You get some music that's really complex, you get some music that's using harmony, some music that's not, some music that's trying to break down all of the rules of harmony. And all along, there's that sort of play with form and structure, play with what's familiar, what's accepted, what's the rules, so to speak, in a particular period of time. And it's very interesting that a lot of the composers that today are seen as very, you know, very traditional, and people might be a bit dismissive of them, were real innovators, you know, and always breaking the rules, always creating new ways of doing things. You know, people like Bach, Handel, Haydn, Mozart, Beethoven, Schubert, all those people, they were great innovators. And why am I saying that? Well, there's something about when you're learning an instrument, there's a whole lot of stuff that you have to do on a very physical level, learn the mechanics of playing the instrument, learn all kinds of subtleties to allow yourself to express, well, A, to make sound. You know, I had a period when I was teaching beginners violin, for instance, and people's initial sounds on violin can be really excruciating. So one of my priorities as a teacher was to get to a place where even if they were just playing things like Twinkle Twinkle Little Star, they could make it with a nice sound, you know. So you have certain technical things, you know, in a way, like the physical posture of playing an instrument, you know, and that's not static. But there are certain things that you do need to do to actually be able to play different instruments, you know, with a string instrument, you know, you've probably got the instrument itself, and maybe you've got a bow to play on it. You know, if you've got a wind instrument, if you've got a brass instrument, you have to play it completely differently. You have to use your body completely differently in order to get the sounds out. And so there's a certain way that you start with the physical posture of playing an instrument. And yes, you can learn how to read music, but that's not essential for being a musician. There are so many fantastic musicians in lots of traditions, classical traditions all around the world, jazz musicians, pop rock musicians who've never learned music but are still fabulous musicians. You know, sometimes there's ways of having some notation to give you a bit of guidance, but it's not essential. And music always used to be something impermanent. You know, in the Buddhist scriptures, we have the teachings about the music of impermanence being played or sung in some of the Pure Lands or whatever. So the fact that we now have the technology to record and preserve music, I think, is a little bit of a I mean, I love the fact that I can listen to all these musicians that I might never have heard, and musicians from the past, and musicians from all around the world, and there are these fantastic performances that are available. If you go on YouTube, pretty much any style of music you'll find, and pretty much every artist that performed that had any kind of success, somebody will have put some recordings of them up there. And so it's nice to see that, but in a way, it's like frozen music. And then you can get into the habit of just listening to the same recording or the same video and thinking that's how that piece of music should be, rather than that there's a vast, infinite number of ways that a particular piece of music can be played. You know, even within classical music, when you've got everything written down very, very clearly, every performance is different. Yeah. Even with the same players, every performance is different. But especially given that lots of people might come along and play that music in different combinations, different groups, there's so much potential variety within something that may appear to be fixed. And certainly when you're playing music, you need not only to have the sort of be on top of it physically and actually learn a piece physically, like how do I play these notes? Because actually they're really difficult and I have to work out what I have to do with my fingers, what I have to do with my arm and my bow in order to do it, and where are the places that I'm likely to mess up and I need to put extra work into it and, get my body familiar with what it needs to do in order to play it, but also get my mind on top of what I need to do it. So I'm paying attention, being attentive. So you familiarise yourself with a particular work of music, you learn how to play it maybe, and then it's like you let go, That's when you can really start being creative with it, really improvise, really express yourself, try and express something that's being communicated by the composer or the music, trying to connect with the people that you're playing with. I mean, that you're playing to, So you have all those different levels, and if you're not playing something that's a solo, then you have that awareness of all the other people that you're playing with. You're trying to, in a way, play together with that awareness. And some of that awareness is conscious, but a lot of it is unconscious and instinctive, or just, being with other people and having a sense of what they're going to do or where they're going to do. And there's no really, sometimes people have different ideas about how a piece of music can be played or should be played. But when it comes down to it, if you want to do a decent performance, everybody has to, in a way, let go of their attachment to their particular interpretation and come together in a sort of shared collective endeavour. Otherwise, it's gruesome. It doesn't work because you can actually hear the people, haven't agreed and they are playing it in their own way and it doesn't really work. It's interesting because you can go back to pieces again and again and again. Sometimes you might play something just once and never do it again, but especially if it's a really, really great piece of music, you would want to do it again, Or sometimes something is very popular and you're asked to do it again and again, even if you don't think it's a great piece of music. For me, I would be very happy never to play Bolero again, for instance. I know a lot of people love it, but for me, he wrote it as an exercise, really, showing off different instruments. And he's written so many much more complex, much more beautiful pieces of music that it's a shame that that, in a way, has become Ravel's most popular piece. So I'm talking a lot about music. So where does this link with what we're doing? Well, I think the sort of themes of self as separate or self as part of the world, part of reality, that can be kind of an enactment of that when you're playing music. And that need to sort of surrender the self. And it's also like when you do let go, when you do open up, I really love the line to be illuminated by the myriad of things from the Dogen reading translation that Paramananda used in his quote yesterday. And I did actually look up some others, and there's one that's very popular that says to be actualized by myriad things, which to me just doesn't have any of the poetry. I want to be illuminated. What does it mean to be illuminated? There's something about opening up to something bigger, higher, that has a sort of transformative, illuminating effect on us, and to be illuminated by the myriad of things. Everything around us can illuminate us. To me, there's something very beautiful and very inspiring about that idea. So, if we're aligning ourselves with reality, if we're trying to come into harmony with reality, what does that mean? If we're trying to align ourselves, with our own inner harmony, create our own inner harmony, what does that mean? And We may all come up with our own answers to that. But I think from a Buddhist perspective, if we're thinking of reality in terms of that conditioned world, you know, being impermanent, that there is dukkha, that things are insubstantial, in a state of process and change, there is no, nothing has a sort of separate sense of self. Those are all things that we're practicing with in our meditation, trying to create the conditions to get there, and at the same time trying to move beyond any idea of attainment. So I think there's something about, you need to set up the conditions first. Paramananda was talking about you know, needing to be in that calm state, you know, I suppose what Buddhists would call shamatha, where there, you have established that calm, that spaciousness, you have kind of stopped being so distracted, hindrances aren't present, which are in a way expressions of how we respond to things like dukkha and impermanence, how we deal with grasping and aversion and delusion in ourselves and in our lives, often get expressed through the hindrances in our meditation and in our lives. So we want to try and create those conditions of emotional positivity, of integration, where we're not in all those old patterns, repeating patterns, habits, bringing to our meditation all those judgments, where we're constantly reinforcing, creating more self, constantly creating more of an experience of duality in a way. So to forget the self is to actually get work with that very basic delusion of ourselves as separate from others, that we do have this separate self. So even though we experience ourselves in that way, and it would be very hard to function in the world if we didn't, there's that thing of needing to have two things happening together, of the being aware on some level of ourself, but not necessarily in a cognitive conscious way, but also an awareness of the world, reality, and ourselves as part of that. And because a lot of us have grown up where there's been so much status given to thinking, to, you know, understanding, knowledge, conceptual mind being valued above maybe more unconscious, more creative mind in some ways. Sometimes we have to work to loosen that. We're not saying there's anything wrong with having a conceptual mind. We need the conceptual mind to function, and actually it really helps us in our practice, our Buddhist practice, our meditation practice. But if it remains dominant, then that limits us, restricts us to that small contracted mind, very much concerned with ourselves, where the ego is very much in control, and we don't get that same experience of being connected, interconnected, that Indra's net image, so beautiful, of everything being interconnected, everything reflecting each other. We're all facets of reality, and we all contain all of reality, as well as reflecting back everything else in reality. So, I really like, I said this last night, but I did really like that sort of simplicity of when we're meditating, we're trying to abide with ourselves with a sense of care and trying to express our love for the world by sitting. But along the way, sometimes it's very hard to have that sense of care. Sometimes we are coming with all our views of not being good enough, all our ways of judging what happens in the meditation, who we are, what we've been doing in our lives, that can really undermine our confidence and our practice, which in a way is the foundation for the hindrance of doubt. You know, not just doubt of the practice, but doubt of ourselves as practitioner. Doubt whether anything we're doing is having an effect or is worthwhile. So we need to, through practice, work with all of these things over a long period of time, often, in order to get to that place where we are able to go beyond that narrow sense of self, you know, go below the conscious, rational mind that's wanting to control everything or order everything or make everything make sense, because it doesn't often make sense. And a lot of the experiences we may have in meditation or in life that may be very true and they point to a deeper level of understanding, a deeper level of reality, may make no sense whatsoever or even be possible to be conceptualized. Probably you've all had experiences in meditation that have been very strong, but you can't really put into words. But you know it's important, you know there's a truth there, and that you can sort of process it, understanding it in a way that's not so rational or conceptual. So going back to music, it's like sometimes, you know, it's a bit like reading. You know, if you're reading and it's something you know, and you're very familiar with, like, say, the puja, Sevenfold Puja, you know. So I think, oh, I'll just do it off memory. And then suddenly you get to think, oh, I don't know what comes next. You know, even though you may have done it hundreds of times, suddenly you just don't know what it's like. And then sometimes just having the words nearby, even if you don't look at them, kind of reassures you and you can do it, kind of thing. So it's a little bit like that sometimes when you're playing music, and certainly classical music, particularly say if you're in an orchestra or doing something in a string quartet, or that you've got the music there and you're using that as a basis and you do refer to it, but actually only a little part of your mind is doing that, and most of you is responding to the other players or what you're trying to express or what you're feeling. But you can also, you know, there's a whole tradition of learning music by heart before you perform it, particularly if you're a concert pianist. That is the expectation now, which I think is a shame because there are lots of fantastic musicians who aren't able to do that because it's a completely different kind of a brain you need to be able to memorize all these pieces. Sort of superhuman. I remember a few years ago, one of my favourite pianists, Andras Schiff, he did all these series of like the complete, you know, sonatas of Beethoven, complete sonatas of Schubert, all of Bach's keyboard music, and he would like do a whole series of concerts within like a couple of weeks or a month, where we'd be playing like, you know, 30, 40 pieces all by memory, and they're all really quite demanding pieces. And he clearly had that, you know, I don't know how he did it. But then there may be other people who are really great musicians who just can't do that. So that's something that's a bit of a shame. But anyway, one of the things about when you're doing something from memory in a way is that it then frees you not to be using the cognitive mind, I guess, that it's so embedded in you. You might be worried about remembering it, and then you are using your cognitive mind trying to sort of think, well, what comes next? But mostly, you're just immersed in the music and just playing it, which I think is one of the benefits of it. But there may be bits there where you do have to think. And I think meditation's a bit like that. You know, particularly at the beginning, I think we probably do need to have a lot of consciousness about certain things, you know, like, you know, getting our posture, maybe learning a particular way of practicing, getting some of the sort of fundamental ways of working in practice, getting to know ourselves, getting to know what are the things that we particularly need to work with, and realizing that some point we can go beyond all the forms, we can go beyond all the structures, beyond whatever someone's taught us, and get ownership over our practice. Over it's our minds, it's our experience, and things don't always fit neatly into boxes, and what might be most appropriate for our practice might not be to do mindfulness of breathing in 4 stages and metta bhavana in 5 stages. Yeah, but you know, they're great forms, they're great structures, but in a way they then allow you to improvise, they allow you to go beyond them once you've got that foundation. That form and formlessness, you know, if we throw out all the form, we might just be sitting there in a soup for years and years and years, not really meditating, not knowing what we're doing, you know. On the other hand, if you never let go of the form and structure, your meditation might grow very dry, it might get very mechanical, you know, especially if you're practicing over years. You may just be doing things on automatic. Like, I've come across people who've been doing the metta bhavana for like 10, 15 years and still doing it the way they were first taught, which might be just like they have to use the phrases. And they've been doing that for years and years and years every time they do the practice, without getting down to, well, what is the underlying purpose of the practice? What am I trying to do in this practice? You know, what will help me to connect with kindness and love and compassion? What will help me to, you know, be kinder to myself, kinder to others? You know, what will help me to work with my craving and aversion in a way in response to others, or my delusions, my conditioning in response to others, and work with that in my mind, become more aware of it in my mind, and through that awareness, be able to change, transform certain things. And again, with a practice like that, bhavana, we always feel we have to make something happen. It's all about developing, cultivating kindness and love and compassion. But often the best way to do that is actually not to try, just to be, you know. So if we can be with ourselves and our experience, if we can have that care, that tenderness, that acceptance, that interest, just that intimate act of sitting with ourselves, whatever's going on, even if it's challenging, that is cultivating metta. That is the first stage of the metta, you know, getting to know ourselves, getting to befriend ourselves, getting to value ourselves. And you can do that through a very body-based approach. You know, you can do that through the breath. You don't have to be thinking at all. You don't have to be saying phrases. But if you have no, the word came up somewhere about discipline. So again, going back to music, I was very undisciplined when I was learning. I would practice when I felt like it, not when I didn't feel like it. And also, I was a bit dismissive about technique, because I saw some people who had just spent hours and hours and hours practicing exercises and scales and getting a really good technique, and then when they played, the music had no soul, no heart, nothing to sort of touch you or take you anywhere. So I was sort of very much about, yeah, being spontaneous, being with the feeling. But then I realized after a certain point that without the technique, I couldn't express myself in the ways that I wanted. It really limited what I could do. So the two needed to be there, and the technique serving the expression. And in order to do that, there was a certain amount of discipline of just actually putting in the hours, you know, repeating things again and again, getting familiar with it, letting my body and everything get familiar with it. so that you know, it's not, when you come across something in a piece of music, it might be slightly different to what you've done before, but because of all the work you've done before, you've got the building blocks, you've got the ability to respond to that, yeah, and use it in a way to deal with whatever challenges, difficulties there may be in that particular piece. So you need some discipline. You know, I was never somebody who practiced every single day. I'm not someone who meditates every single day. I meditate most days, but I might have some times when I don't. And yet meditation for me is so much part of my path. You know, it's been integral, still remains integral to, well, following the way, as in that reading, yeah. For me to follow the way is very much meaning, you know, turning towards myself, my experience in meditation, which then allows me to be much more aware and make choices and do things differently in my life. And it also allows me to feel that connection with life, with others, with the world, to experience it, yeah, not just see it. Yeah, I did think it was powerful what Paramananda was saying about how in Buddhism, reality insight is often described as seeing things as they really are. And as you were saying, yeah, it does imply distance, that it's something outside of us that we're looking at. And that maybe we need to understand in a more intellectual way. I think there's another level of seeing as a metaphor, but I think we do get very hooked on the idea of sight and seeing things in terms of insight rather than being with, understanding, experiencing as a way of describing it. So, like, being with things as they really are, experiencing things that they really are, does actually feel a fuller way of looking at it. And you could, you know, you could use that with any of the senses in a way. Whether you're seeing, hearing, tasting things as they really are, smelling things as they really are, you know, hearing things as they really are. There's something about how the senses on our sense experience connect us with the world. Anything that's come, all our experiences come into our body through the senses. And we have our responses, our reactions from those. But we often do have that Vedana response of finding something pleasant, unpleasant, and then getting into our emotional reactions, and that takes us all the way down into the aversion and the craving before we know it. So, just being able to experience the sensation coming through the senses without doing that is quite, I think, quite important in that sort of letting go of the self. I think Paramananda talked about when we turn towards ourselves really deeply and without judgment, that being a way of stopping us getting into all of the usual good, bad duality, me, mine, me, not me, dualities. And, you know, just being able to have an experience, you know, to hear something, to see something, which immediately, of course, brought up the Buddha's advice to Bahia, which I've always loved and I've always kind of reflected on. The one that begins in the seen, only the seen, in the heard, only the heard, in the cognized, only the cognized. So just having that experience, you know. And from a Buddhist point of view, the mind being a sense organ too, so anything that's arising in the mind, our thoughts also being a sense experience. There was all the talking about mind and consciousness and just being part of this bigger consciousness, you know, rather than thinking of it being our awareness. What's it like to think there is just awareness, there is just consciousness that we're part of, you know, that our consciousness is just a part of a much bigger consciousness. If we think of ourselves as being elemental beings, as Paramahansa was talking, well, in the West, we often think of the elements of just being earth, water, fire, and air. But in Buddhism, we also have the additional elements of space and consciousness. So we're beings made up of space and consciousness, as well as all those other elements. And those are all other elements in the world, in the cosmos, that we're participating in and we're part of. But they're not ours, and we're not separate. Okay, so I'm aware I've kind of gone all over the place with this, and there may not be any clear through line, but I'm also aware of the time, so I think I will stop there and make of it what you will. So we're going to have a period of practice now for the rest of the session. So we'll do a meditation where I might do a bit of leading. And then, no, actually, no, let's start off with a sound meditation. You know, can you just hear sound as sound? But if not, just noticing what your responses, your reactions are. And I will be making particular sounds, probably mainly with singing bowl. But you will have other sounds around you coming and going. So just notice what your responses are, what your reactions are. If there is that thought of liking, not liking a particular sound, finding it pleasant, unpleasant, thinking it's distracting or not distracting. Yeah. And see how your body responds. You know, sound is vibration. And those vibrations are experienced in our body, not just something coming through our ears and into our mind, but the whole body responds to vibrations of sound. So maybe noticing, particularly with sounds around you, if that's happening. So yeah, just get yourselves into meditation posture. And we'll start meditating in about 3 minutes or so. So you may want to sit, you may want to lie down. And we'll do this probably for about 15-20 minutes. So as the sound fades away, in your own way, your own time, ending this meditation. So I'd like to invite you to do a short period of standing meditation. Again, just being there, being aware, being in the world. And when we're standing in a way, we are aligned and we're creating that connection between the earth and the sky in our posture. So I have a period of standing, then a period of walking. Then come back to sitting. And just being open to sensation, so allowing ourselves to be illuminated by myriad things. So feeling that connection with the ground, the soles of your feet, the toes, softening the feet. Feeling that solid ground beneath you, supporting you, receiving you. Down into the ground, into the earth. You might like just to gently Lean forward and back. One side to the other. Sense of flexibility, movement. And come to a point of balance. Aligning yourself with gravity. And the whole weight of your body flowing down from the head to the neck, the shoulders, the torso, pelvis, the legs, down into the feet and the ground. Allowing the shoulders to drop. The arms, the hands hanging down. Feeling the weight of the arms and the hands, fingers and the thumbs. Spine lengthening, rising up towards the sky, neck and the head rising up, but also energetically, that sense of energy from the lower body flowing down to the ground, the spine, the torso, the upper body rising up into the sky. Just abiding with yourself, turning towards your experience, whatever it is, just allowing yourself to be however you are right now. Whoever you are right now. Bringing awareness to your breathing, experiencing yourself as a breathing body, and now standing up, not sitting. What's that like? Always that sense of contact with the ground, sinking into the ground, but standing tall and rising up into the sky. Just noticing what's arising in your experience as you stand. Sensations, movements in the body. Flow of the breath. Your energy, your mood. Feelings, emotions, and thoughts arising, passing away. But you're just standing still. Just standing, just being.
space around you, the environment around you, space you're taking up in the world, being part of the world, part of reality as you stand. So in a moment I'm going to ring the bell, and if you'd like then we'll just have a short period, about 10 minutes of walking meditation.